Welcome to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. Behavior Analysis in Practice is a podcast committed to narrowing the research practice gap and demystifying the research process. Each episode will take a deep dive into the latest work published in Behavior Analysis in Practice, the journal, by interviewing the paper's author about the topic. We'll explore the nuances of each paper and ask the questions you wish you could ask the authors after reading the paper. Hello and welcome back to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. I'm your host, Cody Morris, Assistant Professor of Behavior Analysis at Salve Regina University. And today I'm going to be speaking with Devin Ramey about her paper titled Defining and Measuring Indices of Happiness and Unhappiness in Children Diagnosed with Autism Spectrum Disorder. Devin is a BCBAD and a lecturer in behavior analysis at Queen's University Belfast. She has over 10 years experience working in the field in a variety of educational, clinical, and research settings. And more recently, she's begun involvement in a funded co-participatory research project that aims to improve the quality of educational supports for autistic learners in Ireland. I really enjoyed my conversation with Devin, and I think you will too. So without further ado, here's my interview with Devin Ramey. Hello, Devin, and welcome to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. We're excited to have you.
Hi, Cody. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Now, really excited to talk about your paper. Before we dive into the paper, we always like to hear a little bit about our guests, hear about what sort of drew them to behavior analysis, what their current position is, and why they're interested in the particular type of research they're doing. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I am originally from Texas. And when I was first, I guess, in my undergrad, I had no idea I was going to start out, you know, becoming a behavior analyst. I originally, when I was a kid, I actually wanted to become a pediatric orthopedic. So I initially was pre-med, and then I took my first psychology class while I was at the University of Texas and decided that I wanted to do child psychology. But at the time, I had no experience at all working with children outside of, you know, the occasional babysitting job. So I decided to go get a job at the local autism center and just to get some experience. And then I completely changed my career from that point on. I mean, the experience that I had at the center was life-changing, literally. And I just, the science of behavior analysis made sense to me. And I was seeing in real time the change it was having for the clients I was working with. So after that, I had another change in career, and I decided to go get my master's so that I could get my BCBA certification. So I went to Texas State University, and I had an incredible experience at Texas State working in the care clinic there under Dr. Russell Lane. And yeah, and he was actually who suggested that I should continue and pursue my PhD. So here I am today, and I am now a lecturer in behavior analysis at Queen's University Belfast. So that's me.
How does one go from Texas to Belfast? Quite a jump.
Yeah, everyone always asks me that. So my dad's side is actually Irish, and when I think it was 2013, I wanted to come to Ireland just to visit. So I came with a friend back in 2013. I absolutely loved it. I came back to Texas and I was saying to him that I wanted to move there and kind of put it on the back burner for a while. And then my PhD supervisor, Olive Healy, actually had a conference that she was the head speaker at a conference in Texas. And I was with Dr. Russell Lane, who had introduced me to Olive at this conference. And he was saying she'd be an incredible person to do your PhD with. Yeah, so I was introduced to her and asked her if she'd be interested in working with me. And we worked together and got the application in, and that was the end of history. And then I
That
ended up doing, yeah, I went to Trinity College in Dublin for 3 years doing my PhD with her.
Gotcha. And now you're staying in Ireland, it sounds like.
And yeah, I love it.
Nice. Yeah, Ireland's amazing country. I got the chance to travel there as well. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous and the people are incredible and yeah, I just love it.
Yeah, nice. So what sort of strikes your interest, or what draws your interest, I should say, to this particular topic, this trying to figure out ways to define and measure these indices of happiness and unhappiness. And we'll talk about the rationale of the paper. And so I don't want to sort of have any spoilers or major spoilers, but just like how did you begin to approach this topic? Like, what led you to even pursuing this line of research?
To be honest, it was Dr. Russell Lang. We had initially discussed this as a research topic back when I was doing my master's. And then that is kind of, I took it from there with my application for the PhD. So it wasn't a research study that I got to even pursue while I was doing my master's. And that's who I had initially spoken to about this topic. And then I kind of took it from there with the PhD. And was able to solidify my whole plan for the research. So yeah, that's kind of who put the seed in my head and went from there.
Nice. So, segueing into the paper and looking at the rationale you laid out for the importance of this particular paper, you talk a lot about quality of life for individuals with autism spectrum disorder and the things that may impede or negatively affect the quality of life for that population. Can you speak a little bit about the importance of quality of life and how individuals with ASD may have obstacles to really achieving a high quality of life?
Yeah, so based on the meta-analyses and other systematic reviews that I've read, factors, such as age and having other psychiatric conditions, challenging behavior, and with adults, especially with, autistic adults who lack leisure activities, these are all factors that can impact their quality of life. But what I have found is that an issue with measuring quality of life among, adults and children with autism is that they struggle to report their quality of life in the typical ways that other individuals might report their quality of life. So usually you rely on self-report measures where you're filling out questionnaires or even verbally communicating how you're feeling. So a lot of the time, researchers are relying on proxy reports, or they're implementing quality of life measures that really haven't been validated with this population. So it's not the accuracy and the validity of this of these other quality of life assessments might not be where we need them to be. There has been an autism specific quality of life measure that was developed by, I believe it was McConaughey et al. In 2018. But this was only intended for adults, autistic adults. So it hasn't been used with autistic children, which is kind of what led me down to my focus of trying to find a way to measure this happiness and unhappiness of children on the spectrum.
That makes a lot of sense. And as you were describing the importance of quality of life, really, what it is within the paper, you specify, which I found really interesting and really appreciated, you specify that the quality of life has really been at the heart of applied behavior analysis since the beginning. And you cited papers like Beowulf and Risley, 1968, Van Houten et al. I do a bit of work
in things like ascent and looking at variables related to client involvement and treatment decisions, things like that. And as I've presented that and talk with people about that, I find that a lot of people think that those types of ideas, things like quality of life or client involvement, treatment decisions, are new, like brand new, and that this is like that old ABA never cared about anything like that. And that anyone that's like caring about really connecting meaningfully with a client or making sure they have a high quality life, that that's like a recent in the last 5 years sort of push in the field. And I'm very concerned about that idea, because it's not historically accurate at all. And I love that you threw that statement in here, going like, this is something that has really been at the heart since really the creation or sort of development of applied behavior analysis. So I appreciate you putting that statement in there.
Yeah, and I think, with, especially with Wolf 1978, it's the measurement of, sociability as well. But surprisingly, there have been systematic reviews that have shown that there is a lack of measurement of sociability in behavior analytic research, which is, a bit scary. And that's, something that I repeatedly came across is, there's the emphasis on improving quality of life, yet the measures of quality of life are not always there. Or there's more subjective measures being used, such as proxy reports. And I think I wrote down, if I can find the quote really quickly, that Schwartz and Kelly in 2021, they said that an enhanced quality of life is unequivocally the most important outcome for people receiving ABA services. And we can refer to this paper later, but they emphasize that quality of life should be a primary outcome that you're measuring in behavior analytic research and not something that should be, measured as a secondary outcome or ancillary measure. It should really be at the heart, as, Wolf said, but I think it is. Even though I think everyone's heart is in the right place, I think these measures are often lacking from the research.
Yeah, and perhaps one of the contributing factors that lead to a lack of evaluating and measuring and reporting these particular measures is that they're difficult to measure in many ways, or there at least historically has not been many tools or strategies to measure them in a meaningful way. And so your paper really highlights and focuses specifically on happiness as an indicator of quality of life and the importance of happiness. And then you talk about, as we've been talking about now, that it's difficult to measure. Proxy measures are concerning for several reasons, and that you're ultimately in this paper aiming to hopefully help move the needle forward and figuring out ways to meaningfully and effectively measure happiness as a quality indicator. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, exactly. There really is just a lack of a systematic way, I suppose, of measuring objective, have an objective measure of mood or happiness or unhappiness. There has been, as we'll talk about in the paper, I mean, there have been traditional indices used in the literature, but that's not individualized, and I think it's important that it's individualized.
Yeah, that was huge and a really great point. I'm glad you brought that up, is that individualization, right? That I can't remember if you talked about it in the introduction. I think you did. I think you talked about there's like sort of there had been some standardized sort of strategies proposed for like, yep, yeah, if you see these things, this indicates that the client is, happy or satisfied. And that might not always be reflective of individuals. Could you talk about that sort of that issue or the crux of that concern there?
Yes, of course. So the some of the original studies, they did use these traditional indices. So for example, Green and Reed defined these indices of happiness as any facial expression or vocalization typically considered to be an indicator of happiness among people without disabilities. And this definition was used in multiple studies, and it was based on what you might see in a neurotypical individual, but all individuals, you know, regardless of who they are or if they have a diagnosis, we all engage in different behaviors, right? Depending on what we are feeling at the time. And there is research to suggest that autistic individuals, especially, they can engage in very idiosyncratic, happy and unhappy behaviors. For example, they can engage in vocal stimming behaviors, such as non-contextual laughter. And this might not be representative of their actual emotional state of happiness or unhappiness. And there has been other research to suggest that their portrayal of happy and unhappy emotions, facial expressions, they can be rated as more intense and less natural. So this literature just suggests that autistic individuals can engage in very individualized, very idiosyncratic, happy, unhappy behaviors, which really suggests that they need to have individualized definitions of these behaviors like you would do with any other overt behavior that you're trying to change, right? So this is the importance of defining and operationalizing those behaviors.
That makes so much sense. And I think certainly, you know, speaks to my own personal experiences of my own behaviors and the things that I do when I'm happy. And even the clients that I've worked with, I've had some clients that might make like a humming noise and maybe rock when, you know, they seem to be having a great time. But I've had other clients where they're humming and rocking when they seemingly are very distressed and upset about something.
Yeah.
Right. So I can't overly generalize and go, oh, when clients rock and hum, they're having a great time. Like maybe for some and maybe not for others. And your paper's taking that approach, which I really appreciate. So what did you aim to do exactly in this study? Like what were you aiming to add to the previous work in this area?
So the only other study that my paper is largely based on was by Parsons et al. In 2012. So what I really was doing is I was replicating their procedures to see if these individualized indices of happiness and unhappiness could be identified, operationally defined, and then measured with young autistic children, because their study focused on adults with autism. So there was a change of population, plus they only had, I believe it was 3 participants. I extended that by having 9, so I wanted to have more, and also just wanted to generally see how those procedures would play out with a younger population. The basis of this study really was, and this is part of my doctoral research, so I wanted to see if these behaviors could be operationally defined and measured so that I could then go on to measure them in an intervention, so a choice-based intervention, which is another study that's forthcoming. But that was really the purpose of it, to see if they could be operationally defined so I could measure them later on.
And who were the participants of the study, and where did the study take place?
Yeah, so they were 9 young boys on the autism spectrum who were enrolled in a local autism-based, you know, applied behavior analysis center here in the, well, now I'm in the Northern Ireland, but it was in the Republic of Ireland. And they were all in preschool. So they were young boys.
And did the study take place in that preschool, or like where did you work with them at?
Yeah, so it took place directly in their, so there was 2 classrooms and they were taking place in those classes, so in their typical classroom where they would be during the school day, except for one boy like to have his sessions in like the playroom. So they did have like a separate little playroom on campus that we took them to.
Gotcha. And what were the sort of inclusion, exclusionary criteria, like we don't have to go into all of them, but like what were the big things you were looking at when considering recruiting participants?
So I was looking, well, obviously having a formal diagnosis of autism, but I also, for later on with the choice-based study that followed this first study, was that they needed to have functional communication skills, meaning that they could make preferred choose a preferred item from a selection of at least three items. And they also needed to make a choice between three different, I guess, materials or activities that they wanted to use. So this is later what we investigated later on. So really, it was them being able to communicate their wants and needs and being able to make a choice between three items.
That makes sense. What were the primary variables, dependent variables that you were looking at here?
So there was two, and it was the individualized indices of happiness and the individualized indices of unhappiness for each participant.
And how did you go about the process of measuring them? Because if I recall, it was a sort of a there was a couple of steps or a couple of components involved with that.
So it was actually it was a three step procedure. So the first step was asking the adults that were familiar with each child to complete what I called the indices of happiness and unhappiness questionnaire. This is something I just developed for the study. So it's just a non-standard questionnaire that had four questions. And the first two questions just asked the adults what specific behaviors that their child would engage in when they're feeling happy or unhappy. And then the second two que or the third and fourth question asks what kind of situations or settings are most likely to evoke those happy and unhappy behaviors. And so during this first step, the adults completed the questionnaire, and then I looked at the responses to the questionnaire, and then any common behaviors that were agreed upon by two or more adults, I just circled them and wrote them down as possible behaviors to include. And then the second step was just conducting informal observations of the participants during their school day. I stayed for the whole day observing them during all sorts of situations that might evoke these behaviors, because a lot of these happy, unhappy behaviors would occur throughout the day during, just preferred and non-preferred activities. So I stayed to observe all of the participants, 1 to 2 days each participant, just to confirm the presence of these behaviors and to really get an operational definition of what they look like. And then I operationally defined them. And then the third step was just to validate these indices. And that's really the rest of the study. So that was just observing those indices within those happy and unhappy conditions, just to confirm that they could be evoked an increase and decrease during the conditions.
Right. And when you say validated those indices, you're talking about for each individual, right? It wasn't ne you're not necessarily like validating like the questionnaires being
No.
a reliable or valid questionnaire. It's more about you've sort of taken that somewhat informal questionnaire, right, or unstandardized questionnaire of sorts, and you've gotten a general idea of behaviors that might be correlated with these particular areas of happiness and unhappiness, and then you're going in into different conditions ultimately, and we'll talk about just that in just a moment to see if they're correlated with different events and settings and such.
Yeah, so the conditions are really just to validate these indices that were nominated by the caregivers, by the parents and the teachers. So just to confirm the presence, to validate that what they say is actually the kind of behaviors that they would engage in during situations that we know would likely cause these behaviors to occur.
Yeah, that's helpful. Now, looking at the actual process of that validation arrangement, could you talk a little bit about the experimental design, how you kind of set that up, and then we'll dive into the procedures?
Yeah, so I just implemented an alternating treatment design without a baseline. This is just based on the previous study what Parsons et al. Had implemented. There really wouldn't have been, I kind of questioned myself, how would there even be a baseline for this? I mean, the only hypothesis, I guess, for baseline for this type of study would be the lack or some kind of neutral setting, that the participants could have been in. Placed in, but that wasn't really, I don't think that would have fit in well with their school day because these situations were really implemented during their school day. So, yeah, I just did an alternating treatment design. There was two sessions per day, which were obviously alternated, and no condition was conducted more than 2 days in a row. So it was counterbalanced. Just to ensure there was no carryover effect, I did make sure that there was at least an hour between each session.
And what were you alternating conditions, or what were the alternating conditions, or like, yeah, can you talk about that?
Okay, yeah, sorry, I could have clarified that. Yeah, so we were just alternating the what we called the happy condition and the unhappy condition, which were related to the settings and situations that were most likely to evoke those indices of happiness or unhappiness, respectively. And those were identified through the questionnaire. So when we were selecting these conditions for each participant, we again looked at the responses to the questionnaire to see any agreement between the adults and any conditions slash situation that was agreed upon by two or more. Again, we just identified that as a potential condition to be used in the alternating treatments design. There was only, I think there was two instances where we could not use the situation that was agreed upon. One being that I can't remember which, I think it was maybe it was Lewis. One of the participants, his favorite thing was to go out to the playground. We couldn't use that because that would take too many resources from the classroom because the school rules were that they had to have two TAs go with the child to the playground. So we couldn't do that. And then with Ryan and Daniel, yeah, those are the two. They were twins, and their most likely situation to cause either of them to be upset or have indices of unhappiness was when the other brother was crying. So ethically, we couldn't just evoke crying in one child to get the other one to have his, condition. So we didn't choose that either. So we just went with the second agreed upon situation for both. And yeah, so it was really based on the responses to the questionnaire, agreeing upon all the adults, and just based on the resources that we had in the school.
So it was really only logistical and I suppose ethical considerations with the twin brothers. You're not gonna like poke a brother. Oh, you're crying now. That interfere with that. So otherwise, it was, what do the caregivers, and the caregivers were the parents, where there was multiple people, right? It was.
Yes, it was three people. So it was the parent, the lead teacher of each child's classroom, and then a teaching assistant that worked with them the most often. So the way it worked in the classroom is there was one lead teacher for each class, and then there was, I think, three or four TAs that were in the classroom. So the one that worked with each child the most often.
Did you generally have correspondence between those reporters, or was it, did you have any
Yeah.
major differences?
Yeah, that was, I guess that was the cool thing about it. I think that there was the only notable, and I can't give you specifics at the moment, but
Yeah, of course.
I do remember there being a little bit of a difference between what the parents reported versus what the teacher slash teaching assistant reported. And it could just be, the setting and like the type of activities and toys and whatnot available, but there was a slight difference in the situation slash conditions that the parent would have reported versus what the teaching staff would have reported. But in general, I was able to find an agreement between everyone, for all of the participants.
Nice. And then you went about ultimately then in this sort of pairwise alternating treatment arrangement, exposing the client to the contacts that were potentially correlated or heavily related to happiness and unhappiness and vice versa. And then you were ultimately looking for those indices of happiness or unhappiness to correspond to those conditions. Is that correct?
Yeah, so each condition was alternated, like you said, and it was only 5 minutes long. So that was based on the literature, what Parsons et al. Had done, but also just especially with the unhappy condition, I wanted to keep it quite brief, not exposing him too long to these unhappy situations. But I do want to reiterate that all of the conditions were, I guess, situations that the participants would typically encounter in their school day. So, for example, it's time to pick up your toys. We're all done with toys. We have to go to the table and do some work, kind of thing. Very typical situations. Nothing that they wouldn't encounter during their, during their daily school day. But yeah, so they were exposed to these conditions for 5 minutes each condition, and it. I was thinking about it today that. They kind of represented a like a synthesized condition from like an ISCA because or interview informed synthesized contingency analysis because it was like everything that they would want to be with, all their preferred activities or like adult attention that would might be combined in their happy situation, and then those were removed in their unhappy situation. So there was only a few participants, I believe, that their unhappy situation was different or not opposite to what their happy condition was, if that makes sense. So usually it was the complete opposite. So if they had attention and playing with toys in their happy condition, then their unhappy usually was just the opposite of that and removing the toys and teacher attention.
Gotcha. So, and again, like you said, these are conditions they're experiencing throughout the day, right? It's not, you're not sticking them in the chokey from Matilda or something like that. Just
No,
yeah,
it
exactly.
was just typical stuff that they always encountered, but that the teachers and parents knew that were either going to make them really happy or might make them a little upset.
Yeah. Well, I mean that's logical, right? I mean I'm sure all of us throughout our day have situations and settings and contexts that we're sort of happier to be in, right? Versus times where like this is sort of my least favorite part of my day, right? So I'm kind of, pushing through this particular part. So that makes a lot of sense. Can you talk about what you found, right? So you had the you said the nine participants, you ran them all through their idiosyncratic or individualized conditions, looking for their individualized indicators or potential indicators of happiness, unhappiness. What did you see?
Right. So for all but one participant, the individualized indices of happiness were obviously improved or increased during their happy condition versus in comparison to their unhappy condition. And also for all but one participant, the indices of unhappiness were higher in the unhappy condition versus the happy condition.
So then what are your like takeaway points or what do you think the conclusions are based on the way you approach this particular issue and the results you found?
So I think the most meaningful conclusion from this study is that the indices of happiness and unhappiness can be systematically manipulated through environmental events, right? So we know that we can modify the environment to either increase or decrease these behaviors. So taking that, we can use these indices as direct behavioral outcomes to interventions, decide, this intervention is indeed making my client happier or unhappier. And if it's an intervention that is quite clearly increasing, for example, indices of unhappiness, then we might need to reconsider that intervention, either modify it so that, those indices of unhappiness are decreasing or just eliminating it altogether, right? So this is, I think, a more systematic way of looking at how our intervention, it's a more systematic way of, I guess, evaluating the suitability of our interventions directly from the client to are should be the focus of our sociability measures.
Yeah, that's I keep saying that makes sense. I'm trying to avoid saying the same thing over and over again, so I'm stuck on that. But it's true, it makes sense. Yeah, I find that very interesting. And this research and your research in many ways are related to sort of one of my primary lines of research myself, which I referenced earlier, is looking at assent and client involvement and treatment decisions. And both of these topics, the complication is that for many of our clients, it's not as simple as simply asking them, like, hey, are you cool with this particular procedure? Or in this case, for this study, hey, are you happy? Are you feeling happy about this? Right? It's not quite that easy, right? And it might be that easy with typically developing individuals in some cases, but for many of the clients we serve, it's simply not that easy. And so I appreciate this perspective and looking at indices, and I've done sort of some research looking at the implications of certain indices related to assent and that topic. One of the potential sticky points or some of the feedback that I've gotten and sort of grappled with is the important consideration that reliability or the ability to consistently measure something doesn't necessarily imply validity in all measures. So, the potential criticism for assent, for example, and indicators of assent is just because we can both agree that this particular behavior is, in fact, a sign of assent, doesn't necessarily mean that it is. Having two people agree on something doesn't mean that that is, in fact, the reality. I don't know if that's something that you've sort of grappled with this happiness, unhappiness, and if you have thoughts on that particular topic. It's a lot, and so I don't mean to, throw a whole thing at you, but I'm wondering if you have thoughts on that.
No, I definitely think that's one of the main issues when it comes to behaviors such as private events, such as emotion. I think this is another reason why behavior analysts avoid this topic, because it's quite difficult to measure private events such as, happiness and unhappiness. My thoughts on this, I guess, would be that I'm very interested. I know we're going to talk about maybe avenues for future research, but I would be keen to measure these behaviors while also using some kind of smartwatch, like a some pairing these with physiological measures to look to see if there's actual changes in physiological states as I'm seeing changes in these overt observable behaviors to see if I can further, I guess validate them, because that is the argument, is what we're observing isn't, how do we know that that is actual happiness and that's what they're feeling? But I could say, well, their cortisol level is going down, their heart rate is more relaxed, all these physiological measures that are assumed or presumed to be aligned with calmness, happiness, elation. I would be interested in looking into that to, further validate that. And that's an avenue that I've been discussing with some colleagues. Another thing that I, pointed out, and one of the limitations, I guess, of the study, which we might talk about in a second as well, is that I had a hard time validating it, having the participants themselves confirming, that's how they were feeling. So I did include this self-report measure of mood, which, didn't go the way I had hoped it to go. But I'm wondering, if I were to do this study all over again, I might have first taught this participant how to identify their mood through some kind of, social emotional curriculum, or some, even a systematic behavioral approach to it, to teach them recognize, mood recognition. They, again, there's that argument, are they actually aligning their own emotions and recognizing it, or have they just been taught to recognize different ones? But it would be interesting if they had received that kind of, teaching prior to the study, would they have been able to then recognize their own emotions, which would have been useful and would have been a better validation measure. But I do think, yeah, having a secondary kind of measure would have supported the validation of the indices.
Yeah, absolutely. I think about your study. I think about the approach of your study. You had the stakeholders ultimately involved with, well, what do you think are the behaviors that indicate that this person's happy, right? What are the settings and situations in which you think they tend to sort of display those behaviors? And then you confirm those, right? And we'll talk, I mean, you've talked already a little bit about like the treatment implications of that. And I think at the end of the day, we could go round and round and go, was it really happiness? Can we absolutely 100% confirm it was happiness? And I don't think there's any sort of argument saying, yeah, we can't 100% confirm it. But from a social validity standpoint, from stakeholders being involved with the situation standpoint, of you actually taking the time to ask them about, hey, when is this child? When do you think they're happy? What are the situations in which do you think they're happy? Taking the time to then confirm and go, yep, we see that too. And then going, hey, now that we see this, and these seem to be important, they certainly seem to be important to the stakeholders from the measures you've gone and the process you've gone about looking at it, they seem to be important to the clients. That is useful information for treatment, and that is ultimately improving the social validity of our approach to helping individuals, right? So I think people might get a little hung up on this, that happiness, unhappiness. How do we, you know, I mean, the Greeks, you know, struggled with defining happiness, unhappy. Like, that's something we probably are never going to come to a complete agreement on, right? There's complications with that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that looking at these things as sticky and as indefinable, as complicated as they are, don't actually have immediate treatment implications that are going to improve the way, because, you know, okay, well, they're not happy, but guess what? They're engaging in less, I imagine, challenging behaviors and things like that in those situations. The stakeholders think that they're happy. And isn't that something we want? Don't we want stakeholders and the clients and people from the community going, oh, that kid looks like he's having a blast and having a good time in treatment? And, you know, I understand not every second of treatment can be the fun stuff, right? Just like in regular school, sometimes we got to buckle down and do the stuff we don't love. But isn't that valid?
And it kind of ties into what we were talking about at the beginning of, quality of life being the foundation of applied behavior analysis, improving quality of life. But how are we going to measure it unless we do have some kind of systematic, objective way of trying to measure it, and relying on subjective, questionnaires that are, are usually reported by parents or teachers. I mean, that to me isn't getting to, that is not as direct, or that's not as valid as something like this, where you're defining what these behaviors look like and then directly measuring them as an outcome to the intervention that is intended to improve quality of life.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this process, I mean, there's a lot going on with the study you did with 9 participants, et cetera. But to actually go through the process of like verifying and looking at these particular indices in the different settings, sort of doing the math, it's 5-minute exposures, it didn't really look like it would take that much time and energy to listen. You're not advocating, oh, to figure this out, you all need to do a 12-hour assessment with your client. It doesn't look like it's actually that cumbersome. Is that true?
Exactly. And I guess you could argue, on the other hand, that it might be a little cumbersome to have to validate these indices using, I think it was like 15 to 18 sessions per participant. So one of the follow-up studies that I have actually just submitted for publication that will hopefully, fingers crossed, be published soon, it was actually accepted approved with major revisions. So we have to work on those revisions, but the what we looked at is whether we could repeat this identification, I guess, procedure using an abbreviated validation process. So what we looked at is we did the indices of happiness and unhappiness questionnaire. Then we indirectly or just did observations to confirm the presence of those indices that were identified by parents. And then instead of having this long validation process where we had all these sessions, we just had one happy session and one unhappy session just to confirm the presence of those indices. And then following that, we just had a choice or a choice, I guess, preferred. Sorry, I'm trying to think of the right word for it right now. Sorry.
Concurrent choice, maybe.
Yeah, that's the one. Sorry. That's what I believe Parsons et al. Did at their study. But the reason I did not include the concurrent choice in mine was because I was going to be evaluating choice later on. So I didn't want to confuse the participants by including choice in one study and then having choice immediately after in the next study. So with my supervisee, we examined this abbreviated procedure, and it literally took one day to identify. Well, I guess if you sent home the questionnaires and gone back, it might take 2 days to get the questionnaires back and then identify and confirm the presence of these indices. And then having the choice, the concurrent choice, and the participants were simply asked, which situation do you want to go to? They all chose to go to their happy situation or after happy condition, which just confirmed they preferred that happy condition versus the unhappy condition. So it can be done in a very abbreviated way. And I think that makes it a little bit more useful and practical for educators who might not have the time or resources to do an 18-session study.
Yeah. You know, when I do like consultation, I'm talking with parents or teachers or even other behavior analysts, I sort of often explain what I'm doing or attempting to do as coming up with the right recipe to help, you know, the client gain the independence and autonomy that our treatment's ultimately focusing on. And a lot of times those particular ingredients, I'm pulling from stuff that they're already doing, right? So my job is to go in and observe and go, what are the things you're doing that's working? What are the parts of the recipe that you're doing that's working? And what are the ingredients that I can switch up or add or change?
Mm-hmm.
And I find that a lot of parents, certainly direct care staff, teachers, they often like without knowing it and really necessarily being able to articulate it or describe it, often learn these indices, like learn, you know, and they might say, oh, like I can tell that we're, like so-and-so is in a good mood today and we're going to like, and I can push him a little bit harder, right? Or
yeah.
We can go a little bit faster. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's an important thing. It's that feel, it's that like clinical, sort of clinical instinct feel about how, where's my client at right now? And how does that mm-hmm. then indicate what I can adjust and move? And I think what's really cool about this particular paper and this approach is you're sort of solidifying that a little bit more. Instead of having mm-hmm. the care team sort of all having their own opinions about it and winging it and maybe not confirming it, right? You're going through a little bit more of a systematic approach of going, what are these actual indices of how the client's current state might be affected? And then, you know, mm-hmm. talk about future research and implications, then, you know, what are the potential ways you might adjust your approach given what you're seeing? And I think, again, I think that's really awesome and a very useful mm-hmm. tool.
Yeah, thank you. And another thing that, you know, even if educators, for example, who I know are very busy and have a lot going on in the classroom, even if they don't have the resources, let's say, to do partial interval reporting, which was used, you know, in this study, which is very intense, you know, it's resource intensive. You have to have either someone there helping you, or you need to have, you know, video recording or something like that. So even if you were able as an educator to identify these individualized indices for your client or your student, and then place them in some kind of Likert type, you know, mood rating scale or something like that, but that scale is more individualized to that child, then they could maybe even do a rating at the end of each session or before each session of how they're, you know, what they gauge the overall mood of that child is based on their individualized indices rather than relying on very subjective or those traditional indices that I was saying at the beginning that might not accurately reflect how that child demonstrates their happy and unhappy behavior.
I like that. Now we're getting closer to the end of our time here, and so I want to take some time to talk about maybe, you know, future steps, things like that. Now, again, your study was excellent, but you can't solve all the world's problems in a single study. So what are the potential sort of other research topics, ideas that might come from this? It sounds like you're already working on a couple, and we've sort of referenced them, but any more thoughts on that?
Yeah, so like I said, I think it's very important to be using these, you know, individualized indices as direct, I guess, quality of life outcome measures. And there really is a relatively limited number of studies that have measured mood during interventions. And like we talked about, there's really no universal approach to identifying and measuring happiness. So I do think there is definitely more room for more studies on this and to potentially take this system, I've, you know, preliminary, this preliminary system, and hopefully replicating it in future studies. And we have done that. We have replicated this procedure for, like I was just discussing, we did an abbreviated procedure to identify and measure these indices. And then we actually used them as the dependent variables during a pairing procedure. And we found that pre-session pairing before discrete child teaching sessions did increase their overall happiness during those sessions. So we're using it really as an outcome dependent variable during interventions. And I also found that providing children with more choice during their discrete child teaching sessions also increased their happiness. So really focusing on, you know, measuring these during child-centered approaches and interventions that are intended to improve, you know, overall quality of life. I also, like I discussed, I am interested in, you know, looking at the physiological measures of happiness and unhappiness and looking to see if those indeed, I guess, correlate with what I've seen, you know, the overt measures that I'm seeing. And I would also be interested in looking at some kind of social emotional curriculum, in like we talked about earlier, about teaching the children really how to identify their own, well, emotions in others, but also self-identification of emotional states, and whether that could be tied into this research somehow, because that would be a very useful validation measure, I think, a secondary validation measure. And I really want to keep the focus on, you know, the children and, you know, their own. If they're not able to self-report, then, you know, that it is what it is, that we can go maybe teach them that. And then that would be useful for this research because, you know, I think, you know, with the quality of life, I think it's the WHO definition of quality of life. It's really the person's own perception and of their own quality of life. So it really should be the focus on the children and how they perceive their own happiness and unhappiness and how they might self-report that. So that's, you know, future research that I'm looking at. Yeah.
It's a good research line. I think you're gonna be busy for the foreseeable future, chipping away at
Yeah.
that. For people interested in this topic, you've given a lot of sort of resources and references throughout, so it'd be tremendous resources for them. Any other resources, things that they should check out if they want to learn more about this topic? It sounds like they should keep their eyes out for some of your other research, hopefully making it to light here soon. But anything else?
So I do have, like I said, I have two studies that will be forthcoming hopefully soon. One on the choice, the effects of choice on happiness, and the other on the effects pre-session pairing on happiness. One study that I highlighted at the beginning of our talk was by Schwartz and Kelly, 2021. And the title of it is Quality of Life for People with Disabilities, Why Applied Behavior Analysts Should Consider This as a Primary Dependent Variable. And I think this is a really good study. Like, it just really hones in on the fact that we do need to be measuring quality of life as the primary dependent variable rather than a secondary dependent variable, and the importance of this. So that study discusses all of that. And then, you know, I've discussed how there is limited research out there, but if students or anyone listening wanted to learn more about the literature that is out there on measuring mood, I do have a systematic literature review that has focused on the measurement of mood in behavioral interventions for autistic individuals. And so that's Ramey et al. 2019. And this just really highlights what literature is out there on, you know, directly measuring these overt indicators of mood in the behavior analytic literature. It really shows there's a lack of it, but if anyone wanted to read about that, it kind of discusses the different approaches that have been taken within the literature. Yeah, and I'm sure there's been other studies I've made reference to within the, definitely throughout this talk. I know Baird et al., but we've all talked about it in Wolf 1978, but we, I'm sure everyone's aware of those studies. But yeah, I think that's it. I can definitely send over, if there's like a list I can send a recommended reading list or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have, we'll link to that kind of stuff in the show notes. So yeah, tremendous resources you've provided. Thank you for sharing those. Thank you for writing the paper, and thank you for coming on the show today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening. Please remember to subscribe and like us on whatever podcast player you use, and to find us and follow us on social media to stay up to date on our latest episodes. I'd like to thank a few people for helping create this podcast. Thank you to Stephanie Peterson, the editor of the journal Behavior Analysis and Practice, and thank you to ABAI for sponsoring this podcast. Thank you to my assistant producers, Jesse Perrin, Sarah Sudoff, Shane Rivard, and Hannah Gray for helping create this particular episode. And thank you to Jim Carr and his band New Latitude for letting us sample their song Cruising Altitude throughout this podcast.